Hello and welcome to a Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care CME podcast. Today we are looking at the medications available to us when managing nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Richard Chen to the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care's podcast. Richard is currently the newest fellow of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care, having just completed his training. And in the process of doing his training, he had to do the medical literature project. And he chose to do this on the management of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. And it raised some interesting questions and things that we feel the urgent care community should be aware of. So we asked him if he would like to speak to the podcast, and he kindly said yes. So Richard, welcome, and thank you for agreeing to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
Now, you chose the management of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. What prompted you to look at this particular topic for your project?
I saw a lot of these cases where patients would come in and they would immediately be put on ondansetron. And I always recalled from medical school that ondansetron was a slightly riskier medication to use in pregnancy, previously having been a B1 category. And so when you think about how many women are getting ondansetron, at least at that point, it was an anecdotal perspective. You just wondered if there was something a little bit better, a little bit safer that we could rely on. And so that's why I really looked at what should we be giving first as opposed to just reaching for the ondansetron.
You're right. There's certainly a lot of nausea and vomiting that we manage in urgent care. And there are a number of options available to us from a medical perspective. What are the current New Zealand guidelines that you uncovered regarding the choice of medications that we should be using?
Right. So quite a few different guidelines from different places. We've got BPAC NZ, we've got health pathways, we've got the ED protocols from different DHBs. A lot of them did focus on giving metoclopramide as a general form in PO, IV, or IM as the first line, because that had previously been established as pretty safe. And then ondansetron was also offered thereafter, following some initial treatments, as a physician's request medication. So that one on most protocols in New Zealand isn't a direct standing order, which is interesting, but we give it as if it were a standing order in a lot of our urgent care practices.
You've mentioned ondansetron at the start of this being the prompt for you to look into this topic. What did you discover about ondansetron specifically relating to its use in pregnancy?
Ondansetron is extremely popular because of its oral dispersible wafer form. And there's no doubt that there's a lot of reasons why it'd be easier to access. It's also cheap on the market. The research shows that ondansetron is of some degree teratogenetic in the first trimester and possibly into the second trimester. However, being one of those vulnerable states, pregnancy is very hard to investigate. So the available data is based on epidemiological studies, cohort studies, and some case control studies. And amongst these, there are some that have shown that there is very little teratogenicity compared to a normal pregnancy or other medications. And then there are some that have shown that there has been some increase in oral clefts and cardiac anomalies in particular. And the difficult part about dealing with this is that all of these studies aren't necessarily measured in the same way, and therefore meta-analyses or Cochrane review is very difficult to say one way or the other. But what we do know is that there is definitely some increased risk from the literature.
So in terms of New Zealand guidelines, ondansetron features where in the BPAC and the ED guidelines that you uncovered during your research there?
Yeah, so if you look directly into the BPAC guidelines, it recommends pyridoxine, which is a B6 vitamin, as the first line, but it doesn't put too much emphasis on that being particularly effective for vomiting, that it does only improve nausea. The next line, it would suggest as metoclopramide, which we mentioned before. And then thereafter, it would suggest stimetol, cyclizine, promethazine. Of course, a lot of those are first-generation antihistamines, and you should only use one where possible. And then finally, at the very end, does it mention ondansetron and steroid use. And so ondansetron being so far down the list does show you that guideline makers have known for sometime that ondansetron perhaps isn't the safest one to use.
And part of your project, you performed a survey of urgent care physicians in the Auckland area. And that was interesting because you were looking at their specific use of antiemetics. So if the ondansetron is at the end of the list of the guidelines, and if there are those limited, admittedly, but still studies that show some problems within pregnancy potentially attributable to the ondansetron, what was the use of ondansetron within your survey of doctors?
The survey was quite reflective of my suspicions, which was ondansetron was overused. And the reason why I conducted the survey was to see not just ondansetron, but overall of available antiemetic agents, what was used, and what was the preference of use? Because often when you have a lady who's actively vomiting in your practice, you're going to use probably more than one agent. And like you said, with specific focus on ondansetron, that came up 97 of the sampled physicians. These were all urgent care type setting physicians used ondansetron at some point, specifically as the first line. 26% of physicians used this as their go-to medication, number one, and then as the second one, or as their second line, they chose that 37% of the time. So overall, very highly prescribed.
So contra to BPAC, it's coming in at first and second rather than right at the bottom of the list, which is interesting.
Overall frequency, it was used as much as metoclopramide, which was the other most highly used at 97% as well. Now note, this is a sample of 38 physicians, so we have to generalize that context to potentially being only some of the population.
But particularly in New Zealand practice here, a lot of our prescribing might be governed by the cost of the medication, and in particular, whether or not a medication is subsidized. And ondansetron is a subsidized medication. It also comes in the oral dispersible wafer that you mentioned. So there's two reasons why people might be inclined to use it, isn't it? Because it's convenient for the patient, and it's cheaper for the patient. But if you were to expand this wider into the rest of the medical world, when you looked deeper into the management of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, did you find anything that isn't used very widely in New Zealand that is actually a better way of treating nausea and vomiting in pregnancy?
In the literature, there was quite a few different medications used, and these were all included on the survey. In particular, there was mentioned before on the BPAC guidelines of pyridoxine, and pyridoxine is just another B vitamin naturally found and has been used for a long time. This was mentioned heavily along with another first-generation antihistamine known as doxalamine, which a lot of us may have heard used by pharmacists for sedation rather than as any kind of antiemetic. But surprisingly, this one is has been one of the most used antiemetics in combination, pyridoxine, doxylamine, in both the United States and Canada for a very long time. And it had a lot of controversy around it, and it had a lot of research done on it. And essentially, the end result of that, what they got to was that it was fairly safe and it was fairly effective without the risk of potentially other riskier antiemetics like ondansetron. So I was quite excited to be able to find something that I could incorporate into my own practice to give to these women who were vomiting and be able to say that, look, this particular medication is what we used to categorize as a medicine. Actually, another point is that we don't categorize medications in A, B, C, D, X anymore. So I can get into that a little bit later.
So worldwide, you found that that there was a significant amount of safety evidence, and in terms of using the doxylamine, that it was preferable to all other agents for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. Is that right?
Several international guidelines have suggested the pyridoxine as well as the pyridoxine-doxylamine combination. The latter has actually had more research done on it than pyridoxine alone to be very safe and very efficacious. In particular, there were two studies, although somewhat dated, that included about 200,000 pregnancies exposed to the pyridoxine-doxylamine combination, and there wasn't any increased risk of malformations. And these included specific cardiac, limb reduction, oral, and genital tract deformities. So 200,000 is quite a big sample size, considering we don't do randomized control trial testing in pregnant women.
Yeah, it's a very difficult population to do studies on. And so we are dealing sometimes with grey areas and inadequate information. But when you put this survey to the urgent care doctors, the 39 that you surveyed, did any of them use this combination? Is it being used at all in the community that you surveyed?
The survey, if I gave that to you now, included metoclopramide, ondansetron, cyclozine, pyridoxine, prochlorperazine, domperidone, promethazine, doxylamine, and hyoscine hydrobromide, otherwise the patch that you might use. So the way that the survey was done, it was all listed together, and if a physician were to not choose something, they would actively have to read through it and decide that they didn't want to use that medication or they had never used it before. So of that population who did it, there was only 5% that had ever used doxylamine, and pyridoxine came at 42%, so a bit higher, but certainly not as high as metoclopramide and ondansetron at 97% each.
And metoclopramide is obviously recommended by BPAC as a first line, so that's obviously a fairly that's expected. But the ondansetron, as I say, is the elephant in the room there, sitting up so highly. So if you were to think about this being a change to what you've discovered, changing people's practice, has it changed your practice? Have you started using the doxylamine as a treatment?
Yes, I have. It's a funny thing, because I prescribe it so frequently for pregnant women that I'm getting multiple calls from pharmacists about correcting my prescriptions. They call up and they say, are you sure you want to use doxylamine? And are you sure you want to use it for a pregnant lady? Even for them, because it's so infrequently prescribed for this particular indication, they won't believe that I'm using it. But, you know, when I explain things and they have a look, you know, they're very reassured by the fact that this medication is safe. So we can talk about prescribing pyridoxine and doxylamine towards the end. But yes, I do commonly use this following the acute treatment. The one thing that you have to note with this medication is that both pyridoxine and doxylamine are in the oral form. So there's no IV version, there's no IM version, there's no wafer version. It has to be swallowed. Therefore, it might not be the most useful thing if you've got a woman who's actively vomiting coming into the urgent care. You probably want to treat that woman with some metoclopramide or another form of medication, even if it was ondansetron. If you could limit that use to just being in that initial acute phase and then stop it then and there, as opposed to discharging that patient once they're no longer vomiting, once they're able to tolerate fluids and food, on something that preferably is targeted at when they can't keep things down.
It might be a good point, having said that the pharmacists are contacting you when you're doing this prescribing. There has been a change, as you mentioned, in the way that the pregnancy category, safety categories are listed now, and the old ABC guide has been shelved. So what is the current way of determining, when you look on the New Zealand formulary, at whether a drug is safe for use in pregnancy?
The ABCDX system comes from America and Australia. In particular, our ABCD system historically came from Australia, who still uses that system. A very brief overview of that is A, being used in many pregnant women and demonstrating safety, B, being split into 1, 2, 3 categories. And those 1, 2, 3 categories are stratified based on animal testing. And the thing that most people don't know, including myself at the very beginning, is that the 1, 2, 3 does not indicate that one is safer than three. It just implies that perhaps in animals this is the case. C is then those which may not cause malformations but does cause some harm, and D is those that cause malformations and potentially irreversible harm. And then, of course, you have things like thalidomide, which should not be used in any case. So when you do talk about the system, one thing to note is that even though we say ondansetron is not perhaps the safest medication to use based on the evidence, it's nowhere near an X. It's still, you know, towards the top end of a B spectrum. And what has happened now is that in the U.S., in fact, for many years now, they've moved on to a descriptive system where we individualize the advice we give to pregnant women before we prescribe medications in pregnancy and lactation. And this means that we tell them what is the broad-based data out there for this particular medication. For example, if I were to give you ondansetron in the clinic, in the past, I would have said this is a B-class medication, which means that perhaps it's not the safest medication, but overall women seem to tolerate it well without huge incidence of malformations. And the woman would have to make a choice. And there's good research out there to say that physicians and other healthcare professionals themselves don't understand how we categorize risk. What does that B mean? What are the studies that are involved when we say that this drug has low incidence of malformations or some incidence of malformations? And so what we would like to do now, according to the FDA, is just to say, you know, ondansetron is a potentially risky drug in the first trimester. However, if your symptoms do reflect a certain severity, it would be recommended because it is a potent antiemetic. However, the things that we have found and the research may indicate there's a very slight chance of some malformations, including some heart issues and some cleft palate issues. And so it gives the woman a much more informed choice.
And with regards to metoclopramide, the doxylamine, the cyclozine, the other options, where do they sit on these new scales of risk?
So the stratification of them in the past, which people probably know, was that metoclopramide also came in at an A, Cyclozine came at a B3. Prochlorperazine stimetol came in at a C. Although stimetol was still quite frequently used, the other medications that we talked about, doxylamine and pyridoxine, both of those are A. And I mentioned to you before that the US system and the Australia system, which is what the New Zealand system is based on, is slightly different in that the US obviously have more loopholes to get through for FDA approval. And in the States, the only medication to hold that A category is the pyridoxine combination with doxylamine. So no other medication, even metoclopramide, is considered an A in the US.
So that's quite a ringing endorsement of it as a safety if it's managed to get through the American system and maintain that A category. And like you say, you now prescribe it here in New Zealand, and despite some pharmacists raising the odd eyebrow, what is the cost though to the patient? Is it a subsidized drug here?
Pyridoxine is fully funded, and it comes in 25 milligram or 50 milligram tablets. And so the recommended dosage for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy is 25 milligrams TDS or three times a day from the time of initiation, which often nausea and vomiting, if you look at the research, comes on roughly about 5 to 6 weeks for most women who get it. And then it finishes at about 20 to 22 weeks down the line. So this medication can be given during that whole time. And there has been some good evidence to say that even very high doses, up to a couple hundred milligrams per day, is not toxic to baby or mother. So that one is a pretty easy medication to use with very little room to go wrong. And the next thing is the partner to that medication, the doxylamine. Unfortunately, this one, probably because it's an older antihistamine and they think that there's newer antihistamines out there, more commonly used ones like cyclozine and promethazine, that they don't need to fund this medication anymore. And perhaps you could extrapolate that safety over towards antihistamines in general. And overall, it has been demonstrated that antihistamines are safe. But if you were to practice based on the evidence, there isn't much evidence for medications like cyclozine, promethazine, compared to the doxylamine. And doxylamine at the moment, I believe, from one of my pharmacies, is quite expensive. It was, if I can just grab the figures here, I believe it was something like $12 for 10 tablets, and that was in a West-located pharmacy. So we're talking about $1.20 for each particular tablet. The dosage per day would be one tablet a day, and that is often prescribed at the nocte dosing because of its slight sedative effects. As I mentioned to you before, in New Zealand, it's mostly used as a sedating antihistamine.
So in your experience so far, having changed your practice based on your readings, do you find that ladies who are given the information and the safety profile of this this combination are happy then to pay the extra for that medication, or do you have much pushback regarding the price?
That completely depends on which clinic I'm working at. For a lot of people in Southwest and other poorer parts of Auckland, $12 is a lot of money. You pay $12 to see a doctor, and people don't even have money to do that. And so to give them something that was $1.20 per dose per day would be just out of the question, financially speaking. Whereas if you were to give them something like ondansetron or metoclopramide, essentially, this is fully subsidized. And if you go to a chemist's warehouse or Countdown Pharmacy, it's a free medication. You get a whole month supply for $0, or at most $5 at other pharmacies that still charge you. And so it's a pretty big difference for somebody who doesn't have much expendable income. Where this might be really applicable, where I've had zero pushback at all, is if you work somewhere centrally, Epson, Remiera, etc. These women 100% choose to have the pyridoxine doxylamine rather than continue on dantrolene or use prolonged metoclopramide. One of the other questions that you might be thinking is, we've got a lot of antiemetics. You've said on dantrolene maybe isn't so good based on the available evidence there is out there, but metoclopramide is still a good one. Why can't we just prescribe more of that? And given that it's free for people who get a prescription, why do we need to think about alternatives? And the reason for that is because the metoclopramide has a lot of potential side effects. Recently, I had a patient who had a extrapyramidal side effect with akathisia, the eye twitching, and some tremors. And you know, that took 3 or 4 hours for us to observe her until she recovered from that. And potentially, if she hadn't, then we couldn't send her home. So you can see that metoclopramide, along with other potential prokinetic medications, can bring on those kind of neurological side effects in its heavy and prolonged use. So I wouldn't personally prescribe metoclopramide as a ongoing medication, whereas I can prescribe the pyridoxine doxylamine as an ongoing medication until the nausea and vomiting subsides in pregnancy.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a very distressing thing for a patient to have a dystonic reaction to metoclopramide. So it certainly very much increases with increased use. And if a lady is suffering throughout pregnancy and is taking a lot of metoclopramide, then we're going to start seeing a lot of that. So having read through everything, having looked at all the information, what would be your kind of list of from first to last in terms of medications used for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy?
So I think overall, we should be using more of the pyridoxine doxylamine, especially earlier on. There are some women that you know will have terrible nausea and vomiting in pregnancy because either they've had it before or they have repeatedly come to you and been discharged with ondansetron, metoclopramide, etc. And so these women should be put on the pyridoxine doxylamine for ongoing treatment. And also, there's an element that if you control a disease process before it's got a chance to get nasty, you actually prevent further complications such as admissions, IV fluids. There's a lot of days lost to nausea and vomiting from either reduced quality of life, days lost to work, and this could potentially all be prevented if we were to be able to give something more longer lasting. The next step would, of course, be to give the metoclopramide, which again is very safe, but in restricted dosing. So the dosing is standardly 10 milligrams three times a day as required. When we prescribe the metoclopramide, we don't often say, just take it as required. Often women will do that with most medications we give them. But in that woman who's been having such terrible nausea and vomiting the whole pregnancy, they're going to take it every day. They're going to take it three times a day, if not four times a day. And they're the ones who we would worry about having some of these adverse outcomes neurologically. After the metoclopramide, we could consider other antihistamines, like I mentioned before, cyclizine, promethazine. These are all available. However, they're in the same class as the doxylamine. So if you have, by the research, started the pyridoxine and doxylamine, you should ideally stop the doxylamine component of it, and you can switch it up and try a cyclizine or try a promethazine, the thing you have to note when you do these is that they each have their own slightly different side effects. For example, promethazine has increased sedation compared to the other antihistamines. And again, another medication we use to help with sleep and sedation. Thereafter, and I think thereafter, only after you've exhausted all of those options, should you be looking towards things like Stimitol and things like ondansetron. I think it's very reasonable to use that in the acute setting where the lady's just not keeping anything down. You can't get an IV line in. Let's give her some wafer form. That's great. But I think after that point where they start to tolerate fluids, we can go down this pathway of pyridoxine, doxylamine, metoclopramide, possibly another first-generation antihistamine. And we would hope with these options available, you would control the you would control the nausea and vomiting and be able to discharge this woman with ongoing pyridoxine doxylamine.
Excellent. So the learning points from this would be, first of all, everybody should familiarize themselves with the new categories that you'll see in the New Zealand formulary.
So when you go on there and look now, there's no letters whatsoever. There's a very short blurb about is there any risk in pregnancy? Is there any risk in breastfeeding? And then it will give you a brief summary of the potential malformations or risk that might be passed on to fetus. And so that's a good starting point, and it's better than saying ABC. But it's really good to still know more specifically what those malformations are.
And having familiarized yourself with these, when you're considering prescribing medications, you would try and flip the current trend, it would seem, or the trend that certainly your survey found, as well as kind of other anecdotal evidence there, that ondansetron should really be right at the bottom of the pile as it's recommended in BPAC, and maybe only use it as a last resort to get on top of the situation before then considering things like the pyridoxine, doxylamine combinations for the ongoing ongoing management, and obviously bearing in mind the cost implications that you've talked about. But there are the other alternatives, bearing in mind the extra pyramidal effects of the metoclopramide in longer term use. So coming to the end of your project there, it's changed your practice, which I guess is one of the benefits of doing a project like that. You started with a question and it's changed the way that you practice.
Absolutely. And I've been trying to disseminate this particular set of information to the clinicians around me. Overall, I think that the positive influence of the increase in the prescriptions of pyridoxine and doxylamine with reduced use of ondansetron. If I were to be able to give some prescribing advice with regards to the doxylamine, because often that's the one that physicians don't know about. A lot of physicians, especially GPs, do already know about the pyridoxine the dosings around that. The doxylamine comes in 25 milligram tablets, it is only needed to be given once a day at nighttime. It might help additionally with nausea and vomiting in the nocturnal state. Because of its fairly long half-life, it does really help with what we call morning sickness, because you would still have some of the effects of that medication in the morning, so you would hopefully not feel as nauseous when you wake up.
Excellent. So, Richard, thank you for talking to us about this. Hopefully, as you say, you're trying to disseminate this information amongst the people you meet, so hopefully those listening to us today will look into this. We'll put some links in the show notes so that people can find some of the guidelines and papers that you looked at, and encourage people to check out the new system for pregnancy warnings, and think twice about the ondansetron, and look into this pyridoxine doxylamine medication regime for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. So thank you, Richard, for talking to us, and congratulations on completing your training, and we look forward to perhaps catching up with you again sometime in the future.
Cheers, Guy.
My thanks to Richard for taking the time to talk with us about his project and for providing an up-to-date look at the medications we should be using in the management of nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. If you have any comments, additions, or suggestions, then please email podcast@rnzcuc.org.nz. We will have another CME podcast on the last Friday of next month, and we'll be back next week with another Urgent Bite. I look forward to seeing you all then, but for now, thanks for listening. The information discussed in this podcast was intended for the ongoing professional development of qualified health professionals and should not be used for self-diagnosis. For any personal medical concerns, please consult your usual doctor.